From Harvard University and NYU Law School to the powerhouse law firm Sullivan & Cromwell, Will Meyerhofer appeared to be on the path towards huge success in the legal world. The only problem? Will was miserable practicing law. Will walked away from Sullivan & Cromwell. Will now counsels lawyers worldwide as a renowned therapist and best-selling author on wellness in the legal profession. In this episode, Will shares his insights on how to find happiness and fulfillment as a lawyer, the things that hold us back, and the power of self-reflection and psychotherapy. Enjoy this episode of Iron Advocate as we continue to explore how lawyers can kill it in the law without it killing us.
You're listening to Iron Advocate, the podcast dedicated to you, the trial attorney, sage, visionary, warrior, unfiltered, no holds barred, Iron Advocate. Join Bob Levant, Jeff Riebel, and today's top legal minds on a journey to discover how to kill it in the law without it killing you. Because being the best advocate for others begins with being the best advocate for yourself.
Will, thank you for being here with us today.
Yeah, it's fun to be here. It's good to talk to you guys.
Thanks, Will.
We're super excited about it. So let's just jump right into the suffering of lawyers, Will, since you're an expert.
Yeah, I'm an expert.
Unparalleled expert on this. So you've guided lawyers from the youngest of lawyers to senior partners who have huge books of business. And I can tell you that although Bob and I are very experienced lawyers, we too have suffered from the stress and fear that accompany this work. Is there a common thread that runs through the suffering of lawyers in your experience?
When you're talking about trial advocacy lawyers and litigators, you know, you tend to get people who want to be there, are kind of interested in the work, are drawn to it, you know, enjoy advocacy. You know, it's a little bit self-selecting. So, you know, you start seeing different issues. But if I had to sort of say, okay, the issue, you know, I guess I would say the alienation, you know, the sense of being all on your own. I hear that. And it has different senses. I mean, there's the alienation of being, you know, just in an office all day long. You know, you get in at, what is it, 8 a.m. and you're there till 6 or something writing a brief. And that, I mean, I've had lawyers say to me sometimes they wonder if there's an outside world, you know. I mean, all they do is research and write these big, long, complicated things, and they feel like it's the most isolating job in the world. You know, so there's that. But then even if you're in a courtroom all day, even if you're, you know, one of these lawyers who's surrounded by people and really in the midst of it all, the isolation can be more of, you know, sometimes it feels like no one's on your side, you know. I guess the hardest piece of it is when you don't feel like your client's on your side, you know. I hear a lot from lawyers that you know, they take a contingent fee case and they think, what was I thinking, you know. The client wants you to be obnoxious and aggressive in ways that you think are really not a good idea, or you don't agree at all on how much the case is really worth. They have an unrealistic notion of settlement value or something, you know. So, I mean, there can be a sense here, not only that the other side is out to get you, and they sort of are, right? I mean, it's meant to be adversarial.
So you know, let me.
Your own side is out to get you, yeah?
Oh, God. I mean, the client, right. The how the relationship with the client can shift on a dime is definitely, it's one of the most isolating factors. It's funny. I was struck actually, Will, when I was reading your book, I was struck by the isolation that you could feel lawyers tend to suffer in the profession, both in our day-to-day work and also the silence with which, you know, we tend to suffer in silence. For me personally, and I think I can speak for Jeff, the fear and the vulnerability that we live with, you know, kind of daily about the work, which is the fear of making mistakes, the fear of public failure, particularly in the courtroom, the fear of losing a client, but also the fear that the client is either going to lose faith or get stressed in a way that they sort of turn on you. And for a long time, like I think I can speak for Jeff, felt ashamed and didn't acknowledge this was all going on inside myself. How can somebody in that spot deal with, how can they be helped or help themselves? Can you talk to that?
You know, I always say to lawyers that you have to be a little, it's some realism that has to happen. I mean, one of the most upset lawyers I ever talked to, I mean, this was a strange one. It was a lawyer, a very, very senior barrister in Australia. I work remotely a lot with lawyers around the world, you know. And I got the call, and the lawyer literally had a glass of scotch on the desk. And, you know, I don't run into that. You know, I pointed out that maybe it wasn't the best time to be drinking during a psychotherapy session.
She was it's 5 o'clock somewhere in Australia, I guess.
But it's the perfect guy to be drinking.
Just waved me off. He just lost a really huge case. And she said, I don't know if you understand this. I don't lose, you know, like I haven't lost a case in ages. I am known as the person who just, I always win, you know? And I said to her, well, didn't you sort of expect this would happen? You know, I mean, one thing about trial advocacy and litigation is you lose. I mean, I did, you know, transactional. And, you know, when you're doing a big M&A deal, you just want to close the son of a gun and then go and have a drink and celebrate. But no one loses, you know. Litigators lose, and litigators have to get it through their heads that they're going to lose sometimes. I had a guy down, a junior lawyer down in Texas, and he realized that the partners were sending him cases that were kind of losers. Well, I mean, he's a junior guy, and they didn't, you know, they kind of said, you know, someone's got to take this case because it's a client, and the client is, you know, thinks they're going to win, but it's kind of misguided, and so here, you take it, you know.
But, Will, isn't it like double down, because we have to present to, it's not just that we're telling ourselves, I don't lose. You have to present to the client without fear. Like, nobody wants to go see a lawyer, and the lawyer's like, well, I don't know, I'll do my best, I'm not sure. And so we get forced ourselves into then living the false persona.
That's exactly it. And you're supposed to be this absolute wall of confidence that's just like, no problem, we can do it. You know, and it's a little bit of like some kind of salesmanship that I think some very smart attorneys who are very capable aren't, they just don't believe in it. They don't, why should I have to be this way? I mean, why can't I just be realistic and really tell them, you know, look, it's a toss up. We have this kind of chance. I don't know. Pretend that you can predict the future and that you always win.
I got to tell you this. Jeff and I were, I called him this morning before the episode. Uh-huh. So to add to this, like, you can't show fear and, you know, the clients don't want to hire a lawyer that's fearful. The other side of the coin is you have to, you know, fulfill your ethical duties and give the information to the client.
Sure.
Long story short, this morning, I tried a case, I don't know, about 6 months ago, a jury trial for a client, a very complex case, and it was a not guilty verdict. This morning, his spouse posted a negative review about me on an internet site because apparently I was delivering the information and things they may not have wanted to hear in a way that didn't resonate with them. And now I, you know, I have that. Can you talk to building that in too, which is this management of the clients, the expectations, the stresses with that?
Yeah, I had a lawyer who, God, this client fired him and he was terrified. He went to the partner and he said, you know, I'm really sorry. I did my very best for this guy. And the partner said, it's okay. He would have fired me. He was just, we're the third firm he's used in a row. This guy's notorious. I probably should never have taken him. You know, I just needed the hours or the money or something. You know? And he's like, don't worry about it. They went out for lunch and laughed about it. You know, I mean, this was such a notoriously bad client that, you know, I mean, we need to be more realistic. We need to support each other. You know, I mean, here's another case. This, again, as litigators, you guys can connect with this. You are going to miss a filing deadline. You are going to forget to preserve a defense. You are, you know, or I'm not even a litigator. I don't know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? When you have to get something into the complaint and you forget and you know, threw it up or something. You know, there are all these, you know, or you didn't put it into the one of the motions or something. I hear this from litigators all the time. And I try to say to them that, you know, under chaos theory, the complexity of the system, as you add complexity, the output is going to be less predictability. You know, you're going to have outliers and unpredictable things. It really comes from like mathematics. You know, the more chaos, the more unpredictability. I mean, or the more complexity, the more unpredictable. That's why we get sort of chaos theory. So this is sort of a confusing way to put it. But the bottom line is, if you're working in all these jurisdictions and you have some court where you haven't been before or something, you're going to probably screw up some rule there with the clerk and you're going to miss a filing deadline or some stupid screw up, some procedural something or other. But I've had litigators just have meltdowns on me, you know, because they missed. I had one guy, he missed a filing deadline, believe it or not, with the U.S. Supreme Court. He put it into the calendar wrong and somehow or other, you know, was late. And it turned out to be nothing. You know, he just apologized frantically. He, you know, he's a very senior guy. He'd been at the U.S. Supreme Court before and they said, oh, don't worry about it. It's okay. But, you know, I mean, he saw his life pass before his eyes. I mean, he had a panic attack, you know, cold-blooded terror. And I said to him, this happens to everyone, you know? I mean, this is really the levels of complexity you're working with here. I mean, I always think to myself, like, look at a law book, right? I mean, look at the code, you know, U.S. 18, whatever the hell it is, you know, the criminal code. And the thing goes on for thousands of pages. You know, how is anyone expected to follow all that? You know, how would you ever memorize it or know it? Or, you know, I mean, law is, there's something inhumane or inhuman about the complexity. And so people make mistakes. And, you know, I mean, and the problem, I guess, is if you're really good and you're really smart and you're really conscientious, you get to a point where you're used to winning and you're used to not making mistakes. And then when you make one, it really, you know, can crack your world open and people just flip out, you know.
Well, can I talk about that, Will? So that's a great example of how this senior partner missed this deadline. And Bob and I, and I can speak for Bob on this because we've had a running dialogue for the last 25 years about this kind of anxiety. When something like that happens, the experience of a lawyer, as you just said, it is sheer terror. And they create a story of the catastrophes that follow from that include to the very end, because I've watched this in myself, I'm going to be homeless without a family and completely destitute because I made this mistake. And it just runs in the mind. How do you help folks with that? Because what you're saying is the isolation, and your book, you talk about that really well. How do you get a guy like that, this client, or guys like us, or people who've been doing this for a while, who are very good at their jobs, to actually see a bigger picture and be more compassionate in themselves and not lose it?
Well, you know, you try to get them to laugh at themselves a little bit. I mean, one thing I always go to, they always think, I mean, it starts with, they're taking me out in handcuffs, you know?
Right.
And then, that's, and then the malpractice.
Yeah, or the, no, it's a bar complaint. Right. If the, well, here's the order of it. Here's the order of it, right? It's client finds out, case gets dismissed in one of those two orders. Client goes either to new counsel or straight to bar. Mm-hmm. You get a disciplinary complaint and you get the malpractice suit, and now you've lost your license, right?
Right. And
right,
then you and there. Box on the street. Right? I mean,
exactly.
How is it, Bob, that you've got this down, this fantasy, so well?
You know, here's the thing, right? Fantasy or horror. Let me respond to that real quick.
Go through the whole thing, Bob. Then it goes to.
Jeff has his own version of the fantasy.
Oh, your kids stop talking to you because you've been publicly humiliated, and you know, so you know, your neighbors.
It's embarrassing for them to visit you living, you know, in the dumpster and all.
Exactly.
You lose your wife. You lose your house. You're on the street.
Let me jump in and respond, Will. Over the last, as Jeff said, 25 years, you know, we've had this dialogue that started with us having no idea what we were talking about. But for me, Will, it's that I've acknowledged it. So I'll actually answer your question, is that I've acknowledged all the fears and vulnerabilities, at least those that I become aware with.
Yeah.
And I sit with them. And I do that if I'm on trial. Okay, I'm sure I'm going to deliver the worst closing I've ever done in my life, even though I've done this a lot of times. I'm sure I'm going to, you know, forget this. I'm sure I'm going to forget that. And I acknowledge it, you know, the night before or whatever the case might be. This is no different. So if you could pick it up from there, that, you know, and that's, I guess, we're saying, how do we get lawyers to sit with this?
You know, it's so funny. My old therapist, I always used to say, so what do I do? And she would say, keep coming, keep talking, you know. And I thought, well, that's good for business. I can see why she always used that line. But, you know, that line has some deep meaning. Honest to God, what helps is what we're doing right now. Like, listen to this podcast, guys. It'll help you, you know. I mean, we need to sit around and laugh at ourselves a little. We need to just take the pressure down a few notches, you know. I have litigators who, you know, have night terrors. I mean, they wake up in the middle of the night thinking, oh my God, I forgot whatever, you know, or holy shit, did I leave so-and-so out of that brief? Or, oh my God, that case I, you know, lost last month, is that why I lost it? Did I forget this? Or, you know, and you just, you know, just these terrors. And it helps to get together and talk, you know, to just kind of, first of all, somehow or other, we're all laughing here and going, yeah, me too, you know. Right. Wait, lawyers don't do that enough. They're in their offices.
Nah,
they don't
true.
Get together and just go, oh my God, remember the time I screwed up and forgot that thing? And so that everyone can acknowledge we're all human. We've all done it. We've all screwed up, right? We have to make it sort of normalize it or something, you know, make it normative to be a human being, you know. It's sort of like what you're doing. You're saying, oh, maybe I'll do my worst closing ever. You know, you're saying, it's okay. If that happens, I'll have a good laugh afterwards. And we used to say, my ex was at Yale Architecture School. Yale Architecture School, you'd spend like 2 months designing something, a bridge or a building or a tower or something. And then you would stick it on the wall and like Frank Gehry would come and basically tear it to pieces. I mean, it was Yale. So like the top architects in the world would literally fly in, you know, Philip Johnson would waddle over and tell you how terrible your building was. And the motto of the class was, fuck them if they can't take a joke, you know, because at some point, yeah, you're going to have one of those. You're going to have Frank Gehry openly laughing to the other architects about how bad your project was, you know, but you know, they all went out afterwards together, had falafel at Mamoon's or wherever it was, and had a good laugh about it, you know?
Well, let me jump in on that, Will, because we are so serious as lawyers, and and Bob and I have been having this discussion, we will listen to the dialogue we're telling ourselves. It feels like life or death for litigators because we have a warrior culture, and people come in because we're tough, strong, et cetera, which just amplifies. Well, first of all, it breeds isolation. We talked about that. And it amplifies this feeling of you have to get it right and you have to be strong. And when I read your book, you know, I'm struck by the way you talk about therapy. And look, I've been in therapy for several years now. It has helped me immensely. And the fact that I have not talked about therapy because I considered it a sign of weakness in many ways and didn't want anybody to think there was ever any kind of chink in my own armor. And I'm consider myself to be a pretty open person in some ways, but you know, that's whether that's true or not is another question. How do you get folks like us, litigators, people, trial advocates, advocates of all sorts, how do you get them at least to take the first step to go to somebody like you to have the conversation? Because it is a life-changing experience just to be able to articulate a fear or vulnerability in a safe place. How do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I always say to them, listen, you know, there's no requirement that you be like collapsing when you come here, you know? I mean, I think everyone has this notion that they're going to come see me, they're going to sit down on my couch, burst into tears, you know, and just be like, I'm a wreck, you know? And it's not, you know, that's not ideal, really. It'd be kind of better. I mean, one way of looking at it is I'm not that different from coming to, I don't know, like a workout coach or something, or a yoga instructor, or, you know, I mean, I think of this as a discipline. I've heard therapists say that one of the tricks of success is, you know, the tricks of successful people is that they have therapists. You know, I see a lot of Wall Street types. I'm down near Wall Street, you know, in Lower Manhattan, and I have loads of, you know, bankers and traders and stuff who just come. They just like to clear out their head at the, you know.
So, hey, Will, can I right there, if I could jump in, because I think some of this, obviously there's a societal thing sometimes, unfortunately, about therapy, but it seems to me that the aversion is much more significant in the law because of this, you know, having to never show fear kind of thing.
And it's been medicalized too. The notion is that you're sick and so you go see me and I fix you, you know, which is kind of crazy because it's much more just kind of like having a massage or something like that. It's more of a sort of just something that's helpful to people, you know?
Will, it's I just tell you, it has made me, so being in therapy has made me such a better advocate/litigator. Why is that? Can you speak to
therapy isn't about change. This is like one of the mottos of the modern psychoanalytic movement is this isn't about change. It's about awareness, you know, that I will help you to talk to yourself and just hear yourself and be more aware. You know, your eyes are a little more open. And nobody doesn't want to be more aware, right? I mean, it's hard. I mean, you know, who would want to not know stuff about themselves that they could know? You're functioning better. You're more aware, right? And then change inevitably is produced by that. But I don't have an agenda to change people, you know? I mean, I'm really just there to help you sort of see yourself and hear yourself and maybe get out of your own way, you know? A lot of therapy is sort of giving people an opportunity to kind of get out of their own way, you know?
Well, this idea that, you know, I had said to you, that Jeff and I talk about a ton, therapy certainly helped me acknowledge that I'm not going to stop feeling anxious and vulnerable the night before an opening or a closing or a big cross or a big deposition. That won't stop. This is what therapy did for me. What does happen is these tools you're talking about to be both self-aware and to find ways almost to embrace it. Can you embrace this stuff and it actually?
Yeah, sure. I call that good crazy, you know, in the sense that.
Gee, thanks.
No, you know what I mean? It is. Hey, just like, you know, they
I consider that, myself good crazy, so I appreciate that.
That's a good diagnosis, Will.
Technically, what you're going through is, you know, like people talk about hypomania, which is not full mania, which can lead to psychosis where you're like bouncing off the walls and starting to lose your reality testing, but hypomania, which is like before an exam when you're hyped up, when you're a little buzzy, you're like, ooh, you know, it's like a couple cups of coffee kind of, you know. I mean, that's good. We want challenges in life, you know. I mean, life doesn't have to be without challenges or anything like that. I guess it's just also kind of having some balance between the challenges and also kind of being, you know, we contain this. It's interesting. Human beings have like a child inside us, but we also have this functioning adult. You know, I mean, Freud kind of pointed that out. He made it all complicated with these Latin terms or whatever. Although in German, in fact, he didn't use Latin terms. But, you know, the idea of an id, which is basically this child inside you, and then the ego, which is kind of this functioning adult self. But we do have to take care of both parts of ourselves, right? I mean, there's that serious adult who probably is looking forward to the challenge of going in there and doing something that's a little scary and maybe pulling it off or whatever. There's also that child that, you know, might need to, you know, play video games afterwards and be silly and just, you know, take a break from it all. But you know, there are different parts of us that need to be, you know, addressed.
That's a huge point, Will, that you know, when Bob and I have had these conversations that gave birth to these podcasts, to have these conversations publicly, the lack of acknowledgement of a part of us that needs to play video games or to roam around and do nothing or do something completely different than the law, and a lack of acknowledgement of how damn scared we are when we're going into, you know, an opening in front of a jury, or you have a client's, you know, $1 billion of client's money that is at stake in a trial. Because I do divorce work, I don't do criminal work anymore. Those things are really, really anxiety provoking. And I can tell you from my own experience, and I don't know if this is what your experience is with your clients, is that therapy has helped create more space inside myself that I can acknowledge feelings that for years I'm like, hell no, I'm not afraid. That's other people are afraid. That piece of therapy has really helped me to have a more honest dialogue about, you know, yeah, I'm feeling damn vulnerable. Never would have had that sort of dialogue with myself had I not found a good therapist that has just helped me be more honest. And is that experience you have with your clients?
Yeah, what you're describing is a wonderful way to put really the goals of therapy. I mean, you nailed it, which is, you know, awareness, right? I mean, just, I mean, like I, one of the things I always tell people, you know, social anxiety is so common. And, you know, the defenses are, you know, either you pre-reject, you say, oh, everybody has an attitude in New York, that's why I don't date, or there are no available women in New York, or no available men in New York, or, you know, just all this kind of like, hang on, first of all, that isn't true. Secondly, haven't even gone out and met them yet, you know. or you go to the party and get drunk, so you're walking around drunk off your ass, and, you know, that's a defense. Or you go and you just talk a mile a minute, and no one ever gets to meet you, or, you know, everyone's got these defenses. And I always tell clients, go in and just monitor your body state. And one guy said, well, my armpits were drenched, you know, and I said, and my heart was racing, and I thought, you're in a state of heightened anxiety. You see what's going on? Maybe just try to go to the party and just breathe, you know, and we'll talk about some real simple exercises, like walk up to someone there and just ask them about themselves or introduce yourself. And he said, well, how do I introduce myself? I was like, well, hi, I'm Joe might work, you know. I mean, you know, something as basic as that.
Will, that is so transferable to the boardroom, you know, conference room, courtroom for advocates. So because, you know, and maybe you could speak to that, it developing habits, whether it's, you know, in the courtroom, as I said, boardroom, conference room, you know, getting a cup of water, speaking to the stenographer, doing things to slow yourself down. Can you put that in that context for me?
Yeah, monitor. I mean, you know, this is, they call that just monitor, you know, so much, we somatize our feelings, you know, I mean, our bodies, you know, we all know what being anxious is like, and we stop and think about it. We're sweating profusely. We're having trouble catching our breath, our hearts. You know, the funny thing about anxiety, if it's bad enough, people go to ERs all the time and say, I'm having a heart attack. And they say, no, you're having massive anxiety. You're having a panic attack. You know, that's what's really going on. So monitor that, you know, monitor that state. The other thing is depression. You know, if you, look, it's frustrating and you'll get angry, but don't beat yourself up, you know. All depression really is when the anger goes inward, you know, instead of saying, God, I'm so angry, I lost that case, I want to scream at the sky and, I don't know, whack something with a pillow or I don't know, whatever, you know, I'm just all upset, I'm all riled up about it. But instead you say, God, I'm terrible, I shouldn't have lost that, I screwed up, I let my client down, no one's ever going to hire me again, I'm a failure, you know, and you beat yourself all up and you wind up in a depression. And that's really, and you know, there's a lot of depression among lawyers. And so, you know, the idea is to monitor our what we're doing to our bodies with our emotions. You know, what is our emotional state? What is it doing to us? And then maybe we can pull ourselves out of it. I mean, a lot of helping people with depression is just explaining depression to them, saying, you know, I mean, it's weird depression because it's got two real diagnostic symptoms. You know, one is the absence of appropriate anger. You know, if you ask a depressed person if they're angry, honest to God, every single one of them will give you the same response. They'll say, only at myself, you know? And if you ask them, and then the other thing is this dismantling of self-esteem. You'll say, well, how do you feel about yourself? You know, it's like, well, I you know, I just don't want to be me. I don't like who I am, you know? And, you know, why should anyone be belabored by my presence? You know, that's just self-abnegation, that's absolute crushing of the self and your esteem and confidence, you know?
So Will, can I take all that and back to what Jeff raised about this, you know, feelings of vulnerability that you have. You're out there and, you know, particularly in the day and age of, you know, social media and the internet and how fast information moves, you're always worried that catastrophic things are going to happen. So can you talk to me or a lawyer out there? I wake up this morning, right? I've won a case for a client, seemingly left them happy, and I'm greeted with, you know, the spouse writing this negative review about me on the internet. What do I, like, really honestly, what do I go through in terms of process before determining what to do about it, right? Because I want to go on there and say, you know what I want to say. So can you talk to, like, you know, there's a million of us around that have, you know, some bad Google review or whatever the case is.
Somebody disses you and, you know, you right. feel like you're going to get, you know, I mean, honestly, one thing I've noticed as a therapist is it helps to admit that I can't be everybody's dream therapist. I'm just not the right therapist for everybody. You know, I'm a good therapist for the people who like me, you know, and I have my, you know, fans, but there are going to be people who just don't, you know, I'm not their therapist, you know, and you know, you may not be that person's attorney, you know, I mean, some clients, they want you to go for the jugular and be incredibly aggressive and confident and all that. Others like a thoughtful person who does the research and just says, hey, let's look at this rationally, calm down, you know. It depends who the client is. You can't make everybody happy. You know, you can't win every case. You can't flawlessly never miss a deadline, and you can't be everybody's favorite attorney. I mean, look, as an author, I know that, even as a reader, right? If you're on Amazon and you look at a book and there are no one-star reviews, they're all five-star reviews, you know something's wrong, right? And there's no book out there that everybody likes. Somebody's been paying the reviewers or, you know, this, I mean, and if a book is really popular and everyone's reading it, it's got 300 reviews, I always read the 3 stars because, you know, I may not agree, but I just want to see what the people who didn't like it that much say. And then I always check a 1 star to see, and it's always like, oh, it's the worst thing I've ever read.
And this is coming from an author. So what you're saying is it's all right. Like, this shit's going to happen, right?
It's like a bell curve, man. There's, you know, I mean, look, you can be Barack Obama and people are going to think you're Hitler, you know? I mean, they're going to think you're the worst guy that ever happened, right? I always thought if you hate Barack Obama, I mean, the guy seemed pretty saintly to me, but you know. It's kind of like a bell curve. There are going to be people who weirdly love you, even though they barely met you. There are going to be people who hate your guts and you've never even exchanged a word with them. And there's going to be a vast center that could really care less whether you exist or you don't exist, you know. But, you know, some of it is not taking all of the our feelings about ourselves from the judgment outside. You know, outside judgment doesn't have to be everything. We can be secure in ourselves and think, You know, I mean, Frank Zappa used to say, you know, you might not like my music. You know, you might think it's really pretty weird and turn it off and go, oh, God, that's awful. But, you know, I thought that song was pretty bitching myself. So, you know.
Well, that's a huge point you're making, because us as lawyers are constantly looking outside ourselves because we're dependent upon clients. And so we, first of all, almost all of us, especially trial lawyers, have very developed judgmental minds and inner critics that are brutal, and that helps us in the profession, but it also gets turned against us. And I'm speaking from my observation of other people. I'm speaking my observation of myself, my own inner critic, how I've had to find a way to just, okay, I hear you, and let me put that in bigger perspective. But, and I agree with you, that awareness piece makes all the difference. But I think a lot of our compatriots don't even make that first step to find a good therapist, or to find, you know, we have been so inculcated into the kind of suffering that we think is part of it. And your work is really helping people break out of that. And I, you know, I'm really glad to have you on for that reason. If we can raise awareness of just the fact that everybody, including highly successful people, are having this experience. Barack Obama, I'm sure, has been plagued with self-doubts at times, but he has a relationship to his own inner critic that allows him to do what he does.
Yeah, I mean, what's it like to have people criticize you that harshly all the time? You know, I always think about that. You know, politicians are just got to get buffed. I every once in a while, I'll just write a nice note to one of my local politicians. I'll write Jerry Nadler and say, hey, Jerry, you're doing a great job on one of your constituents, you know, go get them, you know, because you think, you know, it's tough when everybody's always bitching you out about everything. I once got elected to local office, believe it or not. I was the Democratic County something or other. I was one of dozens of people. It's a really kind of symbolic position. A friend of mine was local poly. He said, do you mind? I said, sure. I think one block in New York City voted for me. But I told someone about it. I was sort of crowing and saying, hey, I'm the Democratic County, whatever. And he said, you know, the streets, the garbage doesn't clean up and you've got to, and he starts poking me in the chest and saying, you know, and I don't even know what he's talking about, you know, some issue with garbage pickup or something. And I thought, boy, welcome to being a politician. You know?
I mean, we're right, as lawyers, constantly, there's somebody on the other side of the case all the time, you know, poking at you, telling you what you, everything you did wrong. And you're always worried about that next motion getting filed against you, email. But can I also take this to the culture of big law where you were? And you talked some earlier about how important it is for lawyers to commiserate, really, to laugh about it, to get together and do those kinds of things. So thinking about that your book really addresses some of the difficulties of big law. Let me ask it this way. If you were hired by a new managing partner who wished to improve the culture in an Am Law 100 firm, and she asked you to establish wellness protocols for all associates and partners to follow, what would they be?
Well, here's the tension. I mean, look, there are very smart people there trying to do this, but here's the tension. First, I would reduce hours, right? I would do something McKinsey-like. The notion is, yeah, when you're going to trial, you're going to be working around the clock, but then I'd give you a month off after that or something, you know, or you're on the beach, you know. I would across the boards, make sure that people had plenty of time off. Now, law firms are not going to love that because, you know, most of them is billable hours. I mean, I guess contingent fee or value billing might help with that. But, the number one thing is they need more sleep, right, and they need more vacation. They need to be able to turn off their damn phones and get away from it, you know?
Right, there's the systemic things that are critical, and you have so many really thoughtful ideas in the book, which are not going to happen overnight, and they may not happen in our lifetime.
The financial pressures that you're directly, it's going to make the firm less profitable, which means the profits per partner is going to go down, which means the prestige of the firm drops. Right. I mean, you can see why this is self-perpetuating, you know?
But there's a
change.
There's a little bit of it that is, you know, self-imposed, in that even the little bit of time that, say, the associates can walk away from it, they're prisoners to themselves because of the culture a lot of the time. Let me ask it this way. If there were three sort of rules you could place on the desk tomorrow of every associate, you know, at big law firms across the world. Sort of self-care, reasonable things they could do within the culture. Are there some things you can suggest to them?
Take your vacations, for heaven's sake. You know, it's hard. You know, it's a hard problem. You know, I mean, believe me, I get asked this all the time. If it were easy, with as many smart people as there are in law, they'd have gotten it beat. You know, if this were an easy problem, it'd be done. You know, I mean, yeah, I mean, it would make sense to do therapy. You know, I'm a therapist, so that sounds self-serving. But I mean, come on, get some support, right? At least an hour a week, go and talk to somebody, and just in a safe, supportive environment, have a chance to just say whatever you need to get out. You know, get some support. That's going to help. You know, try not to get caught up in what I call compensatory behaviors, you know. So you've worked, you know, 15 hours that day and you go home and you're just bouncing off the walls because, you know, you get into that kind of workaholic kind of state where you're, you know, you can't go to sleep because you're so hyped up. Guys sleep. They stay up all night playing video games. They don't sleep. It's what they need to be doing. Or they, you know, take cocaine and drink, or they get high, or they, you know, call a prostitute, or they, you know, overeat, or, you know, I mean, I've seen so many compensatory behaviors. I've seen everything from, I mean, you look around a law firm, you know, I've seen anorexics. I've seen, you know, people who are immensely overweight. You know, I think I compensated with food when I was working in big law. So try not to get sucked into that. That's another thing.
Therapy, which will unpack some of this. I guess I would ask this too. I think I heard you say earlier that part of the problem you think people confront at big law is that they end up there because they may be super duper students and the money attracts them there, and they may not know exactly what they're walking into until they're there. Do I have that part right?
Yeah, that's a huge, I mean, look, you've got a lot of people in law who come, they come to me and they're miserable. And what we have to do is this process of trying to figure out who they really are, you know, like who were you before you got swept up in this law school machine and turned into a lawyer? And they say, oh, I love fishing, or oh, my dream was to have a bakery, or oh, I want to, you know, do some, you know, hiking or something. I mean, they were another person, and I have to kind of give them space to get in touch with who they really are and what they, and a lot of times something emerges that's obviously what they really wanted to do. You
know? And Will, isn't it like a lot of people, I think Jeff and I and you go to law school for really good, honorable reasons because the profession can do an enormous amount of good, right? And a lot of folks go for the right reasons. Do you think that the therapy and the things we're talking about, if even taken on at the law school place, can help somebody stay in touch with what their reality of a fulfilling legal career is?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I talk to so many attorneys about that. You know, and the decision is, do I stay? Do I go somewhere else? Do I leave law entirely? You know, the hardest thing is before you know what you want to do in life, you need to know who you are, you know? And the problem with this, I laughingly call it K through JD mentality, where you go from kindergarten to lawyer without so much as a semester off, you know, is that it does create this sort of, well, you never really saw the world outside. So how do you even know who you are or where your place is in it? You just went to lawyer, you know? I understand it. The students say, well, I didn't want to waste time. I wanted to go directly to law school, get it out of the way, you know, and get right to earning and paying my loans off. But you think, well, you kind of need these years off, and the floundering years, you know, those early 20s years where you really don't know who you are or what you're doing, and you kind of go to a few jobs and they don't work out. And it's kind of like dating, you know, I mean, you can't just marry the first girl because she makes sense on paper. You got to have all the other girls and figure out who you are and what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and what Babel means to you.
I think some of it, so to put it into Jeff and my context, I think some of it is that the lawyers have to be okay doing that within the practice. So Jeff and I met at the public defender's office. Well, we met in law school. We worked together at the public defender's office in Philly. Yeah. And, you know, you're just in the bowels of the system, and you're, you know, in true kind of combat every day. And it's like a whitewash. But at some point along the line, and we didn't have a big plan or any plan for after the public defender's office, but I encourage just the associates, public defenders, this dialogue with Jeff and I really started as, you know, a journey to kind of figure out, because even in the sort of exciting world we practiced in, there were those moments when you're like, this is too much, the stress is too much, I'm out. And I think what you just said, rather than it necessarily be a real reason to flee the practice, I think hopefully I see it as more of a calling card for most folks who aren't going to leave the practice to be okay really exploring what their journey within the practice can be.
Yeah, I mean, what's nice about, you know, it took me a while to realize, first of all, I didn't start out working with lawyers, and then I kind of did some publicity for my first book, and people were fascinated by the fact that I used to work at Big Law. It was such a curious thing. It was just like, oh my God, this guy used to be an associate at S&C and he's a therapist, you know? So that I kind of got sucked back into the legal world, and it took me a while to realize, you know, there's some variety. Some lawyers really are cut out for it. Some lawyers come into my office, they say right away, Will, I love law. Okay, that's not the problem. I'm seeing you because you understand law, so I'm here. But, you know, I'm not one of those, you know. And it's like, okay, then what's the problem? And, it, you know, even if you love it, even if it really is your calling, even if, I mean, look, public defenders tend to be the, you know, you're only doing that because you love it, right? You're doing it, fire in the belly, right? You want to save people. You want to help. It's, they're some of the best lawyers I know are public defenders. They're really inspiring, you know. But then they say, okay, it's even, you know, it's the lawyers who say to me, Will, it doesn't have to be this bad. That's the line they use. They say, I love this work. I love advocacy. It's just some of the people I'm dealing with are driving me crazy.
Listen, Will, I will say this to you. Jeff and I are back and forth. I've been blessed to experience some incredible things in the law. And I say to Jeff, I don't know if I would do this over again. So, listen, that's from all of the things we're talking about that come along with it. I won't repeat them, but I say that. I don't know if I do it again.
I don't know. You seem to me like one of these guys who's, I mean, my God, what you've done and accomplished, and you've got this storied career, you know. But I mean, what makes you think that, you know, you wouldn't do it again? Like, why do you go there?
It's a, you know why? Because doing, you know, so I've done litigation work. It's taxing, right? And carrying that fear and vulnerability. Will, if I knew then what I know now, I would do it again, right? All I'm saying is the path that I went through, because I didn't necessarily realize how important it is to acknowledge the things we're talking about. And that's what we're trying to sort of get out there, right? Is that's why it was more painful than it needed to be.
Yeah, it was, you know, that's, you know, this resonates with me a lot, because I get lawyers who love law saying, their line typically is, it doesn't have to be this bad, does it? You know, because they want to do it and they really enjoy it. The question is, can I do it in a way that I'm not losing my mind? You know, not night panics and freaking out and all that kind of stuff, you know? And I guess a lot of it, you know, does boil down to get some support and this awareness thing. I keep going back to awareness, but I mean, that's what my whole field is about. It's like, you know, I mean, one thing that helped me even at S&C was I had one guy there who, I don't know, he just took a liking to me. He took a shine to me, I guess, because we both like classical music. I mean, at that place, it was hard to find people in the classical music, I guess. And he would go into my office and he'd put on, hey, hang on, you know, stick some obscure pianist doing some Beethoven or Brahms or Bach or something. And we would just sit and listen together, you know, and I guess it wasn't billable. But, you know, we'd take 20 minutes and just say, oh, yeah, I like that tempo. Hang on, let me play this other guy. You're going to love his articulation, you know, and he'd put on some Brahms or something. And it was such a pleasure, you know. And inevitably, as we got to know each other, we'd say, so how are you doing? And he'd say, oh, I don't know. My confidence is down. I don't feel like I can do anything right for this partner, you know, and I, you know, we have this case and we're losing or, you know, what have you. And it would help so much just to have a buddy, you know. I guess the competition is a big problem in law. The fact that you're always trying to beat the other guy or make partner instead of the other guy making partner or prove that you're better to the partner than the other associate is, or, you know, there's just so much competition, or prove to the judge that you're better than the other guy, you know. It can be very, it's funny how like, you know, it's commonplace to talk about the other counsel, opposing counsel, as that idiot, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, how many times do you hear lawyers referring to the opposing counsel as that idiot, you know, as if they, you know, opposing counsel are just by definition stupid, you know, and it is, you know, maybe we're a little rough on each other and kind of rough on ourselves. And,
well, Will, that you're, it is an adversarial system. And, you know, to dovetail what Bob said, Bob has, and I think that I'm paraphrasing him right, because of the huge amount of suffering and the fear, the fear that I watched him go through and watch myself go through, it's a lot worse when you don't just say, yep, I'm feeling fear, because you're not only your, and is it your experience with your clients that they're, experiencing a lot of fear, but the fact that they don't acknowledge it creates a whole nother layer on top of the fear that that also eats them up. Is that part of
it? Yeah, it's a whole lot better to say I'm afraid, because, you know, there are techniques too for handling it. You know, you can reality test, you know, so-called cognitive behavioral theory, you know, CBT work can be really helpful around anxiety. Essentially what you do is you say, okay, I'm sweating buckets and I can't breathe. Clearly I'm having anxiety. I've spotted that. Okay. I've identified my anxiety. You know, and then you think, well, what causes anxiety? Well, thoughts do, you know, cognitions. That's where CBD comes from. And the notion is identify the thought that's triggering this. And it's a predictive thought, and it's usually a fear. It's a fear of something that's going to happen, a worst case scenario. So what's going to happen? I'm going to lose. They're going to laugh at me. I'm going to be disbarred. My client's going to sue me. I'm going to, you know, I'm taken out in handcuffs. I don't know, whatever. We've been there, right? So then you do the reality testing, which is you say, well, what's the likelihood? I mean, I have lots of lawyers, and I say to them, listen, no lawyer is going to get, you know, convicted of malpractice if he's trying his utmost for his client. You know, malpractice is when you don't even show up, or you're drunk, or, you know, that kind of thing. You know? It's, I mean, if you're really knocking yourself out and you just lose, that's not malpractice. That's you did your best, you know?
Let me ask you a question about that from the perspective of, you know, Bob and I now 25 years in, we want to be great mentors to the folks that we work with. And I work with, my firm is about 30 of us. I'm out in San Francisco, and I love the law. And I also find it to be all the suffering you're describing with your clients, that resonates with me completely. I have the same kind of feelings. How can I, or anybody listening, what are some basic practices we could engage in to help create an atmosphere where our younger lawyers feel that it's okay to have the breath of their feelings, where it's okay to really explore their humanity, really, and because it'll make them better lawyers. So there's a bottom line aspect to it. It's in our interest to do that. What can we do as more senior lawyers to help create atmospheres in our law firms?
I think you're doing it right now. You know, model being human. Like this is a great podcast. You know, you guys are laying it out there and saying, hey, you know, I mean, it's funny, like I wrote a piece called I Suck at Law. It was actually one of my most popular pieces ever. And I, you know, honestly, I couldn't think of a better title for it. And I just, you know, I had all the usual trolls telling me, you know, you just suck. That's why you're dropped out. You're a loser. You couldn't hack it, you know. And I, you know, part of me was, you know, bristling and saying, hey, man, I went to fucking Harvard. Where'd you go? You know, you idiot. You know, I was top of my class at NYU. Where'd you go? You know, the kind of lawyer competitive, you know, puffing my chest out.
Yeah.
And then I thought, you know, he's right. I suck at law. You know, I mean, the fact is, I wasn't really a great lawyer. Is that okay? You know, but you know, it's sort of like just admitting who we are and making it okay to be who we are. I mean, there's a guy, Dan Lukasik, and you know, who has this site, what's lawyerswithdepression.com, you know, and he's a litigator upstate, you know, a prominent lawyer, a successful attorney, who dealt with, you know, suicidality, severe depression, and has been very public about it, you know. And I think, you know, Dan is, he's, you know, he does have to apologize for who he is. He's an impressive guy. He's a senior guy. He's very effective in the courtroom. He's got a good reputation. He's, you know, he's got his laurels he can rest on, but he doesn't want to hide anymore about living with depression. And, you know, when one person does that, and there are others who have done it, there, I was at a, I think it was the Dave Nay Society, one of their dinners, and there was a partner at one of the big white shoe firms in New York, and he came out and said, I had depression, I was hospitalized, I was suicidal, I got help, I'm back on my feet, I'm feeling great, and, you know, I don't want you guys to feel like you can't get help and, you know, that you have to apologize or hide or get buried in all the stigma, you know, around depression and mental illness, you know. It's okay, get the help you need, get treatment, it's just an illness, and you know, go out there, you know, let's just allow ourselves to be human.
You know what, Will? Yeah, no, go ahead. It's so I want to, it's so important that along with like how we treat one another, both within the case, inside of a case, how we treat each other, but then also without the case, how we as a profession treat each other.
Yeah, do we have to be so mean, right? I mean, whatever happened to just saying, hey, great job, you know? I mean, look, even opposing counsel. If opposing counsel does a great job, you could say, hey, good work, you know? Right. And what if you lose the case? You could say, like in a tennis match, you would shake hands across the net, right? You'd say, hey, good job, man. I'll see you next time, right?
But I think something like that, you know, it's seemingly simple, you know, whether it's a big law or whether whether it's in, you know, the family law context or a PI case, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That is something seemingly small that we can do, but you know, that's a cultural shift we have to make. And I noticed there being these dialogues. You know, the ABA put out a wellness report a few years ago. I'm sure you've read it. And I love that they did it. I respect them for it. But it's got to be, we got to get a little more raw and a little more real about what the problems really are. We can say, oh, you know, we have to have better judicial decorum or lawyers treat each other nicer. But what we're talking about is what it's really about. Like, right, you got to get much more raw.
Down in the trenches, right? You know, it takes, they say, it takes courage to show fear, you know, that to make yourself vulnerable really shows strength, right? That paradox is really huge here. I mean, the fact that I could write something and say, and call it, I suck at law, you know, I did that because I have confidence in myself, you know? Right. I happen to be the world's greatest psychotherapist, right?
Listen, you walk the walk. You left something, you know, you followed your passion, et cetera. And I think a lot of people who maybe don't have passion in the law, the passion is in the law for them. They just have to be willing to have these dialogues about where to find it, how to find it. The law's a great place, man. I mean, you know, I've gotten to, you know, represent all kinds of wonderful people that deserve representation. I love that. And unfortunately, it took me till a little later in my career to realize some of the fear and vulnerability you carry. So if folks do that, they can find their enjoyment, they can find their fulfillment, they can find their passion right within
the law. Yeah, I have lawyers who are really just looking for a place where they can do it and enjoy it, you know. And I think the first trick, honestly, it keeps coming back to it, but, you know, if you want to be that happy lawyer, sometimes just get paid less, you know. I had a guy who left a huge white shoe firm where he was billing 2,800 hours, you know, and he took a pay cut, went to a mid-level firm, is already building a book of business successfully to his own amazement. It's really happening for him. The partners are great. They love him. They respect him. They're encouraging as hell. He's not making big law money, but he's not billing 2,700 hours. He is working more than he thought he would, but he's doing it because he's so happy. He said that to me. He said, "Will, don't freak out at me, okay? It looks like I'm going to bill like 22, 23 this year." I'm like, that's getting kind of up there. And he said, "It's because I love it, man. I'm just out there all the time. And I love bringing in clients. I love that feeling of like, oh man, I scored another one. And I'm going to win this one for him. And I'm going to, you know, do him a good job for
And
him.
You know what? He's less likely to send like the nasty email to a colleague, you know, to an opponent. You know, like it also starts there, right?
He's never disrespectful to opposing counsel. He's too busy being a good attorney, you know. It doesn't turn into this, you know, pissing contest or something where everybody has to be putting everyone else down, you know. And I think his associates like working for him. He's a happy guy. He's you know, that cliche, the happy lawyer, whatever, you know, you see on book jackets. And what did he do? Well, and of course, the other thing is, since he's doing what he loves, he'll probably end up earning more money at the end of the day because he knew it wasn't sustainable. He did 3 years at this firm billing, honest to God, over 2,700 hours. I mean, he was sleeping there, you know, it was crazy. And it was breaking him down. He was one of those guys who came in and just sobbed for the first 3 hours, you know. He was just an absolute wreck. And then we started to talk, and I realized, okay, I get it. You're really a lawyer. You love litigation. You love advocacy. You love arguments and research, you know. So that's not the problem. This isn't getting you out of law. This is getting you into a place in law where you can do it in a way that suits you, that where you can be happy. You wanted a little bit more freedom, a little more autonomy, you know. Autonomy. He needed a culture where he could flourish, you know, basic stuff that would make him happier.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I think that, do lawyers get confused about the money? Because you start off by saying, take less money, that was part of your advice. But in fact, this guy, it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, let go of the money and ended up being happier and may make more money. Is that?
That's the irony of it. Yeah. I mean, look, I gave up corporate law at a top white shoe firm to become a psychotherapist. I mean, there was a step in between. I took a half pay cut to take a job, non-legal primarily. I did some legal, but it was really a marketing job at a startup. That was my next thing. It was in the publishing business. And that was, I think I was, maybe it was about a third off of my salary. And then the next thing I did was go get a social work degree and work at a hospital. I always repeat this, but it's true. I made $26,500 at that job. That was my salary, you know, and people were looking at me like, are you out of your mind? You know, now, thank you very much. I'm doing just fine. You know, I had to trust myself. I had to trust that who I really was and what I really wanted to do would ultimately be appreciated. Now, I may not make what a banker makes or something, but it's plenty. And I, you know, I mean, and how much would you pay to wake up every day looking forward to your day because you love what you do, right? And that's worth a lot right there.
And, I mean, and you're making that's huge. A huge difference. I mean,
how much do people pay for a week's vacation in an island in the Caribbean? You know, like $4,000 or something? You know, I'm talking about not just a week's vacation, but waking up and all the other time when you're not on vacation is fun.
So, Will, if
that's worth a lot.
it's invaluable, right? And so if you could, so on this sort of theme, if you could have a giant billboard outside of every law school in America that encourages students, professors, and school administrators to do things that will make the culture within the practice healthier, what would the billboard say and why?
I mean, at some level, I would love it if lawyers just talk to each other. I mean, you know, they talk about depression spiking with every year you're in law school. And, you know, the first year in law school, talk about isolation. I'd never been in such a competitive environment before. I mean, those first year grades were everything, you know, and it really was do better than all those other people around you. And yet we were all in the same boat, right? I mean, we were a class, but it didn't feel like a class. It felt like every man for himself, right? So I think we've got to find a way to let down our guards and talk to each other. You know, I always put it like open an office, go inside and try to make a friend with another attorney, you know? I mean, it's great to see you guys together doing this, you know, as friends, because I think, you know, my guess here is that you've helped each other a lot over the years, you know, by just being people that you can go to and talk honestly, that you've been good support for each other, right?
You can't believe how much it's, I can speak for myself, how much it's helped me. I mean, we've talked about the fears, the grind, the terror, of the law practice, whether it's, you know, the trial, the performance anxiety, how it affects our marriages, our kids. It's been huge. It's been, you know, it's invaluable.
Well, that advice is, I want to echo that. I mean, Jeff and I have spoken just about every day for like 26 years now.
See, I wish every lawyer had someone like, you know, you guys, like a Bob or a Jeff that they called and just said, oh man, what a week, you know, and just talk, just honestly talk. I mean, sure, find a therapist and you can do therapy and talk. That's great. Maybe you can even find a therapist like me who's kind of a lawyer too, right? You know, but Jeff, just find another lawyer who's a real honest God friend who's got your back, who you can just really be honest with.
And they relate to where you are. I mean, like Jeff said, we've covered it all. Problems with, you know, employees, partners, cases, you know, et cetera. So I echo that.
It's worth its weight in gold, man.
Just that, you know, answer. And if people go do it, and listen, even with a good friend, it's hard in the beginning or with a colleague, but you start doing it and you start seeing the payoff, you know, within your life, your practice. And it just kind of goes from there.
Let's talk to each other, huh?
I notice in my friendship with Bob at different times that, wow, I'm even trying to portray myself to him to have fewer vulnerabilities or fears. And you know, the friendship gets fed, any relationship gets fed by how much you can actually, how truthful you can be about, you know, what you're feeling. I know it's such a basic premise, but it's true.
Whether it feels good just to say that, right? And that's what therapy is about. It's like you just realize it and you say it aloud and you think, oh, okay, now I know that about myself, you know?
Right.
I mean, the fact that even with your best friend, sometimes you're hesitant to be that vulnerable, right? Because it's just so scary as a lawyer to not sound like, I mean, God, we're always supposed to sound like we have the answer. I mean, you know, anyone who knows anything about law knows that you don't know the answer. You have to go look it up. And that's what law is, right? Right. But you always have to sound on the phone. Like, I mean, they say that the reason you make partner in big law is that the junior who did the research can put something in front of your face, you can glance at it, and then pretend that you knew it all along on the phone while you're talking to the client, you know? I had a guy actually describe a partner doing that. I mean, he didn't know the answer. I mean, how would he, right? But somebody put something in front of his face, he glanced at it while listening to the client ramble on, and then he sort of was able to absorb it and fake right. it and sounded like he knew what he was talking about.
Without missing a beat. I get it.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. It's acting. It's an acting gig. You know, I mean, it's like the Rainmakers. Rainmakers half the time don't even do the law, right? They just act like they know everything, and they bring in the business and then give it to the guys who actually are capable of doing the law, right?
Well, that's the people who make the most money. You got it spot on. All right, well, let me ask you a final question. Well, this has been so good. Therapeutic, I might even
say. It does feel a little therapy, right? Yeah. One of my clients says he gets the happy feeling after therapy. I was like, well, what's the happy feeling? He's like, you know, the happy feeling, the good feeling, you know? And I'm thinking, I always think it's like massage or acupuncture or something.
It's like losing weight. I lost seven pounds.
Get it all out. Let's get it out.
Let me ask you a question then, the final question, and me being a little therapeutic with you. So if someone who knew you intimately was eulogizing you and you lived your best life personally and professionally, what would they be saying about you?
You know, I am at that weird turning point in my career. I'm 15 years of doing this and I get mushy. I really do. I get letters from people who say, hey, you remember me? It was about 8 years ago I saw you and you changed my life, you know? Because you just cared, you know, and you can't do my job without caring. You try to be a cynical therapist who goes into it for the money. It's not going to work. You know, you do this because you care. And if you can't find a way to love that person, then you have no business working with them because it's about caring. It's about love. It's about, you know, I'm listening because I care. I'm listening because I know that people have their own logic. And if you listen, they'll start to make sense and you'll start to understand why they are the way they are. And then they can start to understand it. And then maybe the change is possible, you know? So I guess the eulogy would be, you know, he really did care, you know, and hopefully he helped some people, you know, and it really does. It's very powerful. I had one guy years after I worked with him say, you know, I was suicidal when I saw you. I had no idea at the time. I was just a junior therapist trying to help somebody. But, you know, wow, that really was powerful to hear that, you know. I thought I didn't know it, but, God, I may have saved this guy's life. You know? Just listening. If you're listening, you're doing more than you think, you know.
It's powerful to hear you. It's powerful to hear you say that. I hope, I mean, this has been really incredible for Jeff and I hope for people that have the opportunity to hear you through this podcast that they pick some things up from your wisdom. Where can folks find you out in the universe on the internet? Where else?
Well, I have such an impossible name to spell that I just named my site aquietroom.com. I was trying to figure out how to turn my apartment into an office. And my friend said, oh, stop worrying about it. Nobody cares where they do therapy. They just want a quiet room somewhere. And I thought, a quiet room. So I typed it. No one had taken the URL. So if you put aquietroom.com in, you'll get me. And I do. I have a quiet room here, relatively quiet for New York City anyway.
And I'll close by, I can't, there's no way we could possibly thank you enough. And it's been a privilege. Everyone who's listening to this should grab your books and read them. You and I met, Will, just because I grabbed your book, read it, and reached out for you. So I encourage everybody to do that. Thanks again. Can only hope that we get to do this again soon.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Iron Advocate and that you take what you've learned and integrate it into your own personal practice. As always, we leave you with a minute of mindfulness. Breathe in. Breathe out. And we'll see you next time.